curious. Good point. Okay, I think I'm all together now, all wired up. Okay, so where was I? Oh, so the derivatives of mesoderm, okay, when you have, for example, the gonad field, would still be multipotent, but obviously not as potent as those cells that are mesoderm that can give rise to any of the lineages that mesoderm gives rise to. So we have different levels of multipotent. And then finally, when we get to the end of the organ and we're having actually differentiation, the cells are unipotent. They can become one type of cell. They've really kind of made up their minds what they're going to do with their lives, kind of like us in careers. I've pretty much decided I'm pretty unipotent. Okay? You guys are still probably pretty multipotent, if we use the analogy, right? And I described that on Tuesday, and I really kind of talked about that, and it kind of gave you guys the impression that all those cells were doing that process at the same time. So I fibbed a little, okay? Because you and I still have cells in our body that are multipotent. Adult stem cells. For example, in blood. They can become more than one type of blood, right? So the blood stem cells, the adult blood stem cells, can become red blood cells, different types of white blood cells, platelets. So they're multipotent. So blood's a great example of a organ where we have a very proliferative, or very divides a lot, right, stem cells. We have a million new red blood cells every day. That's huge, okay? Men make about a million new sperm every day. Also a lot of proliferation, a lot's going on there. So we've now mentioned two adult stem cells, sperm and blood. And in fact, one of the ways we can, it's kind of unfortunate, but one of the ways we can think about what adult stem cells we have is you think about what gets affected in chemotherapy. Chemotherapy was figured out after people used mustard gas during World War II, and they found that the mustard gas was busy killing off all the dividing cells. And then in about 1960, they started using various chemotherapies. And we've been using the same thing to treat cancer now for about 50 years. And what we do, we really just hit you over the head with a sledgehammer and hope for the best. Okay? Now, it's true. We have refined some specific treatments. There are a few that we know what to do. Gleevec is a good example. Mashlish will talk to you about Gleevec. But in general, we just kill off all your dividing cells with no preference. Kill off everything that's dividing. So that's going to be your various adult stem cell populations. Blood cells, so you become very anemic. You also don't have an immune system, right? Platelets, you can't heal very quickly whenever you have hemorrhage or, you know, blood, right? So all those things, platelets are involved in making scabs, so you don't have them. You also lose your hair, so you can guess adult stem cells, okay, in your hair. Skin. You don't replenish your skin as well because you have adult stem cells making skin all the time. What else do you have when you do chemo? So a lot of people are busy throwing up or having diarrhea. Okay? Coming out one end or the other. And that's because our GI tract is constantly replenishing itself. And that's from the wear and tear of digestion and eating and the food particles and everything else. So we have adult stem cells replenishing our GI tract. So we got a lot of cells that aren't progressing all the way down to the bottom to be unipotent in embryo, but rather are doing it right now, you and I. So I know a lot of you, when you saw it last week, were thinking, that's something I already did. Well, no, you're not done. Okay? So we're all busy doing that all the time. Now, some of our organs, though, don't do it as much. So, for example, most people don't talk about how they have heart stem cells as an adult. Okay? They've done some tests, and at the moment they feel that for your heart, about half of the cells in your heart will divide in your lifetime. Not a lot. Okay, now if you have cancer, that's a different story, but in general, in a normal heart, so what happens if something goes wrong in your heart? Heart attack and frequently death. So you can't repair it as well. Okay. So from last week, if you remember, I handed out 10B at the top, talks about some of the sources or natural sources of stem cells. There are a few extras here if you need one. But I'd like to kind of make a table about our various types of stem cells. And I'm going to start off doing what are the natural sources of stem cells. So, and you know what, before I do this, I really have to define stem cells, which I haven't done yet. So that's something I have to do. So before I get to that chart, a stem cell. Anybody have any thoughts as to what would define a stem cell? Since it's in your notes, I'm not going to ask you to think of that because that would be an obvious answer. So the first one is self-renewal. So when a stem cell divides into two, but it also, one of the two that it divides into is it makes more of itself. So it's always making more of itself and making a population of stem cells. And number two, upon receiving the proper signals, it divides or gives rise to cells that can then differentiate into a specific differentiated cell type, such as a neuron. This is my artistic abilities, very simplified version of a neuron. So, even though adult stem cells are only multipotent, they still have these two properties. They self-renew, and they, upon stimulus, can differentiate. And yet, naturally, we have other sources of stem cells, and yet they still have those two qualities. So even though stem cells can be very different, if you remember last week I talked to you about embryonic stem cells, which is when you take that inner cell mass and you put it in a petri dish. Right? Those are pluripotent. Adult stem cells are multipotent, and yet they all have these two qualities. So let's talk about some of our natural sources. So I'm going to start off with the ones that are most potent. And so that's really going to be from the zygote up until the 8-cell stage, and that's totipotent. The ICM, or inner cell mass, / ES cells, these are going to be what kind of potency? Pluripotent. Oh, and you know, I've kind of not gone in perfect order because now I'm going to list the primordial germ cells, which of course should really be here because if they join together, they can form, right? You know, actually, if they join together, they're totipotent. And since we're talking only about natural conditions, I'm going to keep it that way. SC standing for stem cells, so adult stem cells. And I've already given that away. that they are multipotent. And there are now a few kind of exceptions, but I'm going to maybe list them anyway. So, for example, any of the tissues that are not part of the embryo, that come out with the embryo, so extra-embryonic tissues, like the umbilical cord, is multipotent. So it can't form every organ of the embryo. And also the fact that it is early in development, so usually its potential is greater than, let's say, adult stem cells. And in the news, you hear sometimes about companies that will harvest your stem cells from baby teeth, from your menses, from your wisdom teeth. I would say they're even lower down on the totem pole as far as how multipotent they are and how many of those cells there are actually there. And we don't yet have really the techniques to use those cells yet. You know, if you freeze it down 40 years from now, will we have those techniques? Question is, do you want to pay for them to be stored until we do have techniques? Don't know. Okay. So these are really our various possible natural sources, and you'll see that on the top of that handout, they show that both the inner cell mass, which you can take out into a petri dish and make ES cells, and you can really do the same thing with the PGCs and put them also in a petri dish and then give them various stimuli, okay, in order to differentiate. All right. So now we're going to start to go into the realm of artificial or manipulations that we do in the lab. In vitro fertilization. Oh, I'm sorry, yes.
What's special about the umbilical cord, and why is it only multipotent? What kind of cells can the umbilical cord cells differentiate?
Okay, so the umbilical cord, first of all, is a fetal tissue. And so its proliferative abilities are going to be more than, let's say, the ability of my cells to proliferate. Okay? So to begin with, they have more, quote-unquote, potential, okay? Their most commonly used or common, you know, thing that we think about is blood, okay? Very good source of blood, okay? So that people talk about using the umbilical stem cells to create blood, and there's also been people who have taken those cells and used them for various mesoderm lineages, okay? They have had more trouble trying to make them into any kind of ectoderm or endoderm lineages. So they're a reasonable source for various types of mesoderm lineages. Okay. Another thing that's kind of interesting, since you bring it up, that I haven't really mentioned yet, is it seems that those cells, when you put them into a human body, frequently have less immunorejection, even if you put them into a different human body. Okay, and so that seems to also be make it a little easier for experiments. Okay. Okay. Yeah.
After only like three divisions, they're already starting to consider some kind of direction. Like that's fourth division, they're no longer.
Right. So at the 16 cell stage, the 8 cells in the middle start upregulating OCT4, and the 8 cells on the outside start upregulating CDX2. So they're no longer, the 8 cells in the middle can now make all of the various embryo lineages, but not the placenta, which was the outside cells. The outside cells can make the embryo lineages, but not the rest of the embryo. Yeah?
The PGCs, that's post-castration. Why is it so?
primordial germ cells.
Right.
So they are... No, so this is what I mentioned before. Germ layers and germ cells, totally different organisms. PGCs are your sperm and egg. Okay? So maybe I should write that here just so we know. Right? Primordial germ cells. Sperm, egg. Okay? So, it's true we had the germ layers. These are the germ cells, not to be confused between the two. Does that answer your question? Okay. So, I think that we're going to have lots of questions because everybody loves stem cells. So I'm going to do a few of the various manipulations we can do, and then I'll get some more questions, okay? All right. So, in vitro fertilization, where we take the egg out of a woman's body and put it together in a test tube with sperm, and we can get an entire individual. Okay? Recently, the Nobel Prize went to a man who actually figured out the conditions that are necessary in order to do in vitro fertilization. And in vitro fertilization gives rise to an entire human being. I think they say now there's about 4 million in vitro babies in the world. Totipotent. As a result of this work that was done, that enabled us to do in vitro fertilization, the conditions that were needed in order to take the ICM out of the embryo and put them into a petri dish and figure out how to culture those cells in the petri dish were worked out. Okay? So as a result of the work with IVF, we then got ES cells. We didn't know how to do that before. Okay? Number two is somatic nuclear transfer or DALI. I abbreviate this SNT. And once again, we are creating an entire individual, so totipotent. So as Dolly, most of you have heard, in 1997, Wilmot was able to, quote, quote, clone a sheep. Okay? We use cloning to mean a number of different things. Here, I'm going to go through the process of what I mean by cloning. We have since then cloned prize horses. You know, like there's a horse that everybody that's got amazing characteristics, so they've cloned those horses. They've cloned dogs, cats. They've even cloned a rhesus monkey, so a primate. They've never managed to clone a human. Okay? So let's talk, and this is in the last time's, last Tuesday's handout, at the bottom of 10B, we'll go through the process of somatic nuclear transfer. Okay. So I do not profess at all to have any kind of artistic abilities. So this is my idea of a sheep. So, two female sheeps. One donates an egg. We then remove all of the DNA, suck it out, so here I'll make this as our DNA, that I'm sucking out, so we now have an enucleated egg. So all of the cytoplasm, none of the chromosomes. From here, from the second sheep, also a female, we take a somatic nucleus that is fully differentiated. And we happen to take it from an udder cell, but we could have taken it from any fully differentiated cell. So it's 2N, right? We take its... So here's the cells. We've got them in a petri dish. They're growing. Okay. We take the nucleus from one of these. And we then transfer it into here, into this new... this empty enucleated egg. And we end up with a 2N, right? So we've got two copies of the DNA that are both derived. Let's call this sheep A, the donor of the egg, and sheep B, the donor of the nucleus. So the egg is derived entirely from A, the nucleus entirely from B. They then culture this in the petri dish. Okay? And then transfer this to a third sheep's uterus, also female. And we get Dolly. Because, of course, two X's that were transferred from the original female, Dolly is also female. Dolly is actually able to reach maturity, give birth to a baby, but dies a little early. Okay? But Dolly is reproductive. So all the cells of Dolly contain the same nuclear DNA as the cells of sheep B. And so we say it is a clone of sheep B. But Dolly is not a true clone. A true clone is like identical twins. Identical twins, you have an egg. And at some point along the beginning process, the cells that have been... Okay, so there's an egg. It was fertilized by sperm. Starts to divide. And at some point, let's say at the four-cell stage, it divides into two totally separate embryos. Identical twins. Dolly, on the other hand, is not 100% derived from sheep B. What is not derived from sheep B? The cytoplasm of the egg. Do we have any DNA in our cytoplasm? Mitochondrial DNA. So the mitochondrial DNA, which is primarily responsible for various genes involved in metabolism, right? The various processes that occur in the mitochondria are derived from sheep A. The nuclear DNA, which gives rise to most of the characteristics we see, right, when we look at each other, sheep B. So in fact, we did this, we used two different strains of sheep. A was black, B was white. Dolly was white. The gene that, you know, decides pigmentation was in the nucleus, so Dolly would be the same color as sheep B. I should probably, just so we don't confuse ourselves, write BL for black, so you don't confuse it with sheep B. Okay? All right. So, a number of years ago, in the news, you may have heard, there was a scientist from South Korea that said they had cloned humans. Remember that? A little while ago? And there was a big stir. Oh my gosh, we've cloned humans, right? And he published a couple of articles in Nature, one of the scientific journals. It's very well respected. And after a while, people started to suspect that maybe he hadn't cloned a human or done somatic nuclear transfer. So how did they check this? They went back. He didn't actually make humans. There was no one walking around. Okay, he actually let it develop to be a blastocyst, right? That stage where you've got the outer layer that will become the placenta and the inner layer with the ICM in his freezer in liquid nitrogen. Which is the okay? So he's got these blastocysts in the freezer. And nature went and checked what is the DNA content of these eggs, blastocysts, embryos. And what they did was they checked to see if the mitochondrial DNA was from a different person than the nuclear DNA. Because if he did this procedure, right, SNT, the mitochondrial DNA should be from a different person than the nuclear DNA. And it wasn't. So he hadn't done what he claimed to do. Now, someone will say to me, but couldn't it be that he did the procedure but with the same person's egg? Well, it could be. But he didn't claim that. His article, he claimed to do it from two different people, person A and person B. So they know that he falsified what he published. Okay? But also I need to then go back a little bit and talk to you about why these experiments were done. Okay? We're not trying to create, for example, I'm not trying to create, or scientists in general, 200 copies of myself. One of me is enough. Enough. So why do people do this? Right? There's a lot of ethical issues with doing this in humans. Why are people trying to do this at all? So in the 1950s, they actually started doing this kinds of experiments with frogs. Okay? And what they were trying to prove is something that I've stated to you, and so is incredibly obvious to all of you, as we know that's true. But it wasn't known then. What they were trying to prove is that the DNA in every cell is the same in our entire body. And if they could take any cell in sheep B and use it for this experiment and get an entire individual, or sheep in this case, that proves that every cell contains the DNA that's needed to create a whole individual. Okay? So in order to prove that, they wanted to separate the nuclear DNA from everything else and show that this nuclear DNA was enough to create Dolly. And so on purpose, so that they could scientifically dissect the pieces, they on purpose used a different sheep for the cytoplasm and a different sheep for the nucleus. Okay, so you should think about that a little. Now, someone will say to me, okay, but they could take a female, you could never do this with a male, but take a female and use her egg and use her somatic cells, take the nucleus, put them together and make a perfect clone of her. Well, you could. All right? At the moment, we don't actually have the technology to do it in humans. But theoretically, we could. We've done it in rhesus monkey. Maybe eventually we could do it. But that isn't really the reason that we are so interested in somatic nuclear transfer and in ES cells in general. The reason we're interested in them, as opposed to creating whole individuals, so ES cells, we can use them to inject them into a blastocyst, right? Put them inside together with the other ICM cells and have them contribute to a organism, right? Not really why most of research is doing these procedures. Most of the time we're doing it because we want to take those ES cells and give them specific signals to make specific cell types for therapeutics. What do I mean by that? We want to make neurons for that we can inject into someone if they have a neurodegenerative disease. We want to make beta cells that will help diabetics make insulin. We want to make cardiac muscle to help someone who had a heart attack. And so we want to put these cells into a petri dish and make the various cell types that a person who's sick needs. If we do that from a different individual, let's say we've got leftover IVF embryos sitting in liquid nitrogen, and we take the ICM cells from there and use them for a second individual, there will be issues of immunorejection. The immune system will identify those cells as foreign and reject them. So this person that would get those various cells that we had created would have to be on various types of immunosuppressors. What if, instead, we took this procedure and the person who needed them donated their nucleus? And down here, when we have now a 2N nucleus, we put these now into a petri dish, added the correct signal, and now made neurons. We could take those neurons and inject them back into the nuclear donor and have no immunorejection, because all of the proteins that the immune system would see on the outside of the cell would be the same as for that individual to begin with. So the immune system would recognize those cells as self. So the advantage here is there would be no immunorejection. Okay. So, I've talked about IVF. A couple can't have kids. They go into the lab. They create kids. We got 4 million of those. I've talked about somatic nuclear transfer. Two important things about it. One, it proves that all cells contain the same DNA. There are a few exceptions. Let's ignore those for a while. And so it was proof of principle, but also it enabled us to make cells that we could differentiate that wouldn't be rejected by the organism because of an immune rejection. Three I have to list are the ES cells, that you would take cells from the ICM, and then those ES cells, you would then differentiate into various tissues. Here there would be immunorejection issues, right? If you have a heart attack and you need new heart cells, you definitely can't take your ICM cells. They are gone a long time ago. They made you, right? So that kind of brings us back to this question I asked you guys, and that was, people ask me, why can't we make a perfect clone? And I've now said, I think, 3 times, this is the third, we can. But what we really need is cells to help someone who's had a heart attack. Most people who've had a heart attack are no longer of reproductive age. Most people who have neurodegenerative diseases are no longer of reproductive age. And so even if you happen to be female, you probably don't have any eggs. So you couldn't take their egg anyways, right? When you're thinking about doing therapeutics. And so that just isn't reasonable because of the fact that the people who need these cells are not reproductive. And of men, of course, men, forget it, no eggs. Okay? All right. So, the next type, okay, so I should mention, these cells are pluripotent, just like the ICM, right? So the next type is called induced pluripotent stem cells. Right, or what we call iPS. And these cells, as their name gives away, are pluripotent. How many of you have heard about these induced pluripotent stem cells in the news? Okay. So what are these creatures? So they started off by taking skin cells. Happens to be fibroblasts of the skin. And introducing four of my favorite types of proteins, transcription factors. Okay? Four transcription factors they put into these fibroblast cells of the skin. And they have, as a result, created cells that in many of their characteristics are like the ICM or ES cells. I will tell you that a lot of the work at the moment is looking to see if they're really the same. Okay? We're doing a lot of checks to figure out, are these cells really the same? But this is a pretty cool idea. Okay? It means that without physically fertilizing an egg, you can get pluripotent stem cells. If you think about the ethics behind that, you know, there could be some real advantages. One of the disadvantages is if we go all the way back to pluripotency, not in the context of an embryo that's very well regulated and controlled, rather, by doing this drastic measure of introducing these transcription factors, can we actually regulate growth of these cells properly? Which is really a challenge to science at the moment. And so frequently these iPS cells have a risk that they don't proliferate properly and they become cancerous. So the person who first did these experiments, his name was Yamanaka in Japan. You should listen for that name. It won't be long before he wins the Nobel Prize. That's my prediction. We'll see. He found that about 50% of his iPS cells, when he tried to then put them back into mice, caused cancer. So once you start playing with the cell cycle, things are pretty dangerous. Got to be careful. You got to regulate it perfectly the way it is regulated in any embryo that actually manages to be born, right? So a lot of development is actually regulating your cell cycle properly, at the right time, in the right place. So there's been a lot of work done then lately to not go all the way back up that potentiation ladder. So if I'm just going to remind you, right, we talked a lot on Tuesday, totipotent, pluripotent, multipotent, unipotent. Obviously, potential is greatest here. Potential is the least here. This is potential. For the different number of cell types you can become. Because remember, almost all of these artificial means, unlike natural development where we go from totipotent to unipotent at different speeds, but it's almost always from totipotent to unipotent, in our artificial methods, we're going back up the hill against gravity. Right? Obviously, it's not gravity, but you get what I mean. Okay? So the further back up gravity you go, the more you allow proliferation. So when you make iPS, you go from unipotent all the way back up to pluripotent. So lately, they've been looking for ways to only go from unipotent to multipotent. And that way, not have proliferation be as crazy. Because pluripotent stem cells proliferate like crazy. Okay, that's an embryo. You can imagine how much you need to proliferate to go from one cell to a baby that's born. Okay? So as the potency decreases, so does proliferation. So I can put here also proliferation. So in the last couple of years, they've managed to take those same skin fibroblasts and make neurons, but only going through to multipotent and coming back. Or to make cardiac muscle, but only going up to multipotent and coming back. How did they do that? With a different combination of transcription factors. So all of these switches that we're talking about, okay, and this is going to be just from uni to multi. These are all going to be, this is with transcription factors, and here also with four different transcription factors. So as I told you before, transcription factors are very important in cell fate determination, and in fact are frequently the master regulatory genes. Remember I talked about that, how at the top of a pyramid that activates the various structural and functional proteins that are needed in order to confer that cell type. One of the ones I love the best, there was an article where they talked about, wouldn't it be great if you could do liposuction, we could all use a little fat taken out here or there, and use those cells to make heart. So not only do you get rid of a little fat, you get new heart cells. I think that's perfect. That's the way to go, right? We should all sign up for that. Okay. All right. But also, I'd like to, kind of along this theme, tell you another little story, also about heart. I'm very biased to the heart. About zebrafish. So zebrafish is a vertebrate, as its name implies. Little guy gets to be about this long, okay? And it turns out that it's much better, as are many of the lower vertebrates, frogs, newts, zebrafish, it's much better at regenerating than we are. We're not very good at regenerating, okay? In embryo, yes. But once we're born, maybe if we get a fingertip cut off, we'll manage. But cut off a hand, forget it. Right? You know, you really can't, we don't proliferate very well at all. On the other hand, a zebrafish cut off its fin, regrows. A frog rotate its eye, reconnects its neurons, no problem. Okay? You know, you sever the spinal cord in a fish, that's okay, no problem. Regrows them. Cut off the bottom 20% of the fish's ventricle, only has one ventricle and one atrium, unlike us who has two of each. Cut off that bottom ventricle, 20% of it. Regrows it, no problem. So what is special, right? Because it's got a different proliferative ability, right? It can proliferate. So it turns out they did a very cool experiment. They can take one of the cell cycle regulatory genes, and I don't know how far you guys have gotten, but in our cell cycle, mitosis, G1, DNA synthesis, G2, we have some checkpoints that you have to get through in order to progress in this cell cycle. Some of those checkpoints are right before mitosis. So, it's actually the gene of interest happens to be called MPS1. None of you should memorize that. Just trying to give a name to the gene. That if you... So I guess I need to tell you a little bit more about the difference between us and zebrafish. So in zebrafish, you cut off the bottom 20%, they regrow them. What happens in us? With us, if we get a heart attack... We're not able to actually, those heart cells, as I told you, almost never proliferate. And so they can proliferate a teeny bit, right? Half of them divide once in your lifetime. That's like nothing, right? What good is that? So, Instead, if you have a heart attack and certain, let's say one of your coronary vessels is blocked and certain part of your ventricle doesn't get oxygen and those cells die, fibroblasts come in and eat those up and macrophages and, you know, do all that. But the macrophages eat it up and the fibroblasts secrete an extracellular matrix protein called collagen that makes scars. So instead of you making new cells, you form a scar in your heart. The cells around that will grow bigger to try to compensate, but frequently don't do very well at that. Being bigger is not always better. And your scar, as you can imagine, extracellular matrix proteins, can't contract. So the remaining cells have to actually do the rest of the work. And if the scar is big enough, you die, because you can't. So you actually form a scar on your heart. In the zebrafish, normally, it's able to proliferate, has MPS1, this protein, checkpoint protein, continues. When you have the stimulus that this region of the heart has been cut, it enables you to cycle and go through this cycle, and you get new cells. You actually get proliferation of those cells. What happens if you delete or get rid of MPS1? You don't cycle, and the zebrafish forms a scar. So it shows you how important the regulation of cell cycle is at all points in your life. Not only cancer, but in our case with the heart, you don't divide enough when we need it in response to a stimulus. The zebrafish does, and does it just fine. Okay. So I've really kind of mentioned most of the various things we're doing in the lab. But I'd like to mention one more, and that is that lately we've been building bladders and tracheas. So how are we doing that? You know, a trachea with all its cartilaginous rings is morphologically, or its shape, is very hard for us to form in a petri dish, as is a bladder. So what we've done, instead of having to make those shapes, because we don't really have a whole organism that has the right stimuli to cause it to create those shapes. Instead, we've taken a trachea from someone who passed away, and we've gotten rid of all the cells on that trachea, and then used the cells from the individual that needs the trachea, from their bone marrow, let's say, for example, adult stem cells, and put them on that structure that we have from the first trachea, those cartilaginous rings, okay? They're not the cells themselves, but they're the things that cells secreted. The cartilaginous rings or collagen or extracellular matrix that's been secreted by those cells, and it gives you that structure. And we put these adult stem cells from the second person on that structure, and they grow, secrete more extracellular matrix. And you put it back in the person. They did that recently in England. Okay? And she's breathing away with her new trachea. They've also done something very similar with bladders. Take a bladder from someone who's passed away, get rid of all the cells, but keep the structure, seed on it new adult stem cells from the person who needs the bladder, insert the bladder into the person. So we've found a way to create shape without us having to give the cells all the stimuli that are needed to create shape. So it's kind of a way around having to go through all the processes that are necessary during development. Okay, so now I'll take a few questions. Yeah?
So there are like 4 blood registries, and people pay, you know, at birth they pay a heart event, and people pay like $3,000 a month during the course of their children's life.
Now it's actually down to $100 a year.
Really? Oh, okay. But my question is, what of this are they promising or can they actually do with that for a child who gets leukemia or a child, like, or has CF or, you know, that type of thing?
So leukemia, because the umbilical cord is pretty good for blood, you know, there is some work that's being done, and I'd say that's the closest, right? You know, that's really something that seems to be not that far off. That's about it, right? Like, we're not doing things with it yet. It doesn't mean that they don't promise, they don't say to you in those ads, what will be in the future, who knows? Maybe you could use it. And a lot of people bank on the future. No pun intended, right? We'll see. You know, science has obviously done some amazing things. Very good question. You know, we'll wait and see. Yeah.
For the zebrafish example, the MPS 1 gene you referenced, is that a gene specific to zebrafish that humans just don't have?
There is a homologue, but I will have to tell you, not just one. Multiples. And so it gets much more complicated. You know, one thing that's nice about the zebrafish is a little simpler. Yeah.
You're talking about the trachea and putting the cell, the stem cells, the adult stem cells on top of it. So are the signals to those stem cells coming from the actual structure, the cartilage, or how do those stem cells differentiate from the trachea? Is that, you know, from those proteins that are there?
So to some extent, yes. Right? There's a huge signal when you're on cartilage. That's a huge signal, right? But also from the medium that they're soaked in. Okay? So when they're doing this and making this, it's not that they've got just the trachea. They soak it in medium and they've worked out the conditions that are necessary. Yeah?
So would you be able to do it with an artificially created collagen mold?
So they're working on those. In fact, here at Columbia, one of the we don't have very many moving parts in our jaw, but there is this bone here that connects into our skull. And they have actually used artificial substances, seeded adult stem cells on that, and used it to transplant. So Gordana Vunjak-Novakovic has done this here in biomedical engineering here at Columbia. So yes, there are all kinds. And in fact, the biomedical engineering department works on a lot of artificial, because of course, the number of donor tracheas or donor bladders is, you know, dependent on people dying, right? Which is not great. So it'd be much nicer if we could have various biodegradable substances that could be used at first, and then the cells could replace those with their secretions of extracellular matrix. Great question. Yeah. Okay, so I'm going to now feel free to ask me more questions, because of course this is a blooming field and just every day something new and interesting. And it's really, I know that I'm being, you know, unashamedly kind of, you know, plugging my course, but we talk, I'd say, about a third or half the time, or maybe even more, about stem cells and how they work and how they're regulated and how we regulate all of development. So feel free to take my course, okay? But also feel free to, you know, ask me about any of these things we've talked about. But I do want to use kind of one example of differentiation. I promised you sex, so I'm going to have to start and talk about sex. So that's what I'd like to talk about now. Okay, and that's on your handout that I handed out today. And really, there are four decisions. Decisions, now, I will have to state, remember, four decisions during embryo that decide if you're male or female. This does not at all deal with what happens at puberty when you further develop. These are what you get in embryo. So remember that. We've got four decisions, and I've actually stated them over there. Sex determination. Decision one, gonads. Two, primordial germ cells. Three, ducts. Four, genitals. So that's what we're getting to. Four decisions. Everybody says what sex you are is determined in mammals by your chromosomes. It's true, okay? But truthfully, the only thing your chromosomes determine is what the somatic cells of your gonad are. So the chromosomes, XX being female and XY being male, only decides if you get a testes or an ovary. That's it. And then your gonads decide everything else. So your sex chromosomes decide that. So if you're XY and you make a testes, your somatic cells, not your germ cells, not the sperm, we haven't gotten to that yet, your somatic cells of your testes are going to be of two types. Sertoli, and Leydig. So your chromosome XY, this Y chromosome that makes you male, makes Sertoli and Leydig cells. That's it. XX, so if you don't have a Y chromosome, ovary, two types of somatic cells, nothing to do with your primordial germ cells, with your eggs, nothing to do with that. Granulosa and fecal cells. That's what your chromosomes determine, period. Now, this is pretty interesting. How many cells in your body do you have that under normal conditions can become two different cell types? Not many. We call that bipotential. The gonad, which is actually located near your kidneys, in the genital ridge it's called, is a tissue that exists there and can become two different things. Bipotential. And in fact, we have a bunch of bipotential. So I'm going to just write that over here because I have them listed. Bipotential. Can become two different things. Okay. Once that's set up and decided, your primordial germ cells or your PGCs are born somewhere else or start, you know, getting their fate determined somewhere else. Then they migrate up your gut and into your genital ridge. So they migrate into here. Whatever your gonad is, if it has Sertoli and Leydig cells, your PGCs become sperm. If it has granulosa and fecal cells, they become eggs. And so your PGCs are determined by your somatic cells of your gonad. So, we've had one decision. We've decided about the gonad. Our second decision is decided by the gonad. And we've got two more decisions. The gonad decides them both. So, it actually, the gonad decides the PGCs and our next two decisions, which are ducts and genitals. So, let's see what they are. Ducts. So, this takes us to 11B at the top. See, I have a whole empty board, but it's my trick board, so let's see if I can make my board work. All right. So, once again, as I said, not a great artist, but you've got gonads, one on each side. Oh. Some similarity to the picture? Not really. Anyway, this is our gonads. In our body, voila, stayed. Okay, in our body, we have two different tubes or ducts that enable our gametes to get out of our body. This inner one that actually connects to and touches the gonad is the Wolfian duct. And it is what will persist in males. And I'm not going to write them down because you don't need to know them, but it gives rise to the epididymis. Okay, now you're going to try to write them. All right, doesn't matter. It gives rise to the tube that leads the sperm out. That's all I care that you know. Okay? So the Wolfian in the male, I should have connected this up. Okay, the inner one that's connected. And this one here, the one that's not connected to the gonad, is the Müllerian, and that'll be in the female. So it turns out that which one you keep, right, is dependent on the secretions of the gonad. So the gonad, if this happens to be male, so there's a Y chromosome that made Sertoli and Leydig cells, your Leydig cells secrete testosterone. In order for the Wolfian tube to remain, you must have testosterone. So, Wolfian equals testosterone, which is made in your Leydig cells. What about the Müllerian duct? In order to kill it off, or to get rid of it, to cause it to be degenerated, your Sertoli cells must secrete anti-Müllerian hormone. I will tell you ahead of time, it is a horrible name because it is not a hormone. Okay? It is actually a paracrine. So plus or minus AMH. So the Müllerian, in order for it to exist, needs to be an environment without AMH. So if you are male, you will have both testosterone and AMH, AMH, which equals Wolfian. And if you are female, you will not have either of these, which will equal Müllerian. So I'm going to write minus plus minus, right? You don't have either. So unlike the gonad, which could become two different things, a Müllerian or the Wolfian form, so the ducts are not bipotential. What about the PGCs, the primordial germ cells, your sperm and egg? Bipotential, thumbs up. Not bipotential, thumbs down. What? Yes, the question again is, are the PGCs, or the primordial germ cells, can they become two different types of cells? In other words, bipotential. Thumbs down for no, thumbs up for yes. Come on, a few more people got a vote. Nobody sees you. Go ahead. All right. Your PGCs are bipotential because they can become either sperm or egg depending on what kind of somatic cells are in your gonad. So, decision number three. Whether or not you have ducts. So you've got ducts, but that's not quite enough, right? You need to have also external genitals. So you can get your... So that you can either give your PGCs or get PGCs. Sperm, if you're giving sperm or you're getting sperm. Okay? But also to get then your embryo out. we have internal fertilization, so females need to also be able to get the embryo out once, because it doesn't get fertilized outside. The sperm comes in and then the embryo comes out. Okay? So we've got a third decision. And I'm going to make this arrow a little shorter only because I've used up my room, not because it's less important. Okay? So here we go. The fourth decision, genitals. And that you can see also on 11B, but at the bottom. So, your genitals are formed from the perineum, which is a region between your belly button and your anus. My magic board. Let's see. Okay. And once again, my artistic school skills, not so great. But if this is then a picture like at the bottom of 11B in between your legs, so if this is the genital lubricant, okay, and these are the various folds, and this is the anus, these tissues in embryo will form both the male and the female genitalia. So we start with the same tissue, the perineum. Make ourselves a chart here, though. So in both of them, the same tissue will form the anus, or the end of the GI tract. Right? I've already labeled it here. This is obviously the front, so this would be ventral, and this would, well, all right, ventral. So ventral being tummy, dorsal being back. Oh, I love this board. All right, so in the male, the genital tubercle becomes the penis. In the female, the clitoris. Now, a lot of people, for some reason, think that the penis is equivalent to the vagina. No, not equivalent. I'm not sure why. Okay. The same structure or tissue that forms the clitoris forms the penis. Okay. Now, the penis, though, is also wrapped by various tissues. So it's not just the genital tubercle that creates it, but let's simplify a little here, okay? Then the males, as opposed to the females who have the vagina, which hooks up to the... So the outer portion of the vagina comes from this perineum. The inner portion comes from the Mullerian duct. Okay? In the females, the Mullerian duct forms the top part of the vagina, the cervix, the uterus, and the oviduct. Okay? Once again, you don't need to memorize those. Okay. So that region there that would become the vagina in here... has these tissues from the outside close over it. And so what then becomes the scrotum those outer tissues would then for the female be the labia major. Now I told you that this becomes a scrotum or the sac that for the testes. But meanwhile, I've told you and shown you a picture where the testes are sitting all the way up here and the genitals are all the way down here. So one of the things that has to happen is that these gonads have to drop and be external to decrease temperature for sperm. Someone asked me, why do you need decreased temperature to make sperm? I don't know, and they're actually working on it. I know a lab that's working on why. We just know it's true, okay? And there are hormones that make this move, okay? So, same tissues, okay, making these various things. So, the external genitals are bipotential, would be thumbs up, not bipotential, thumbs down. Bipotential. So in this system, we got a lot of bipotential organs. 3 out of 4. But that kind of brings me to this idea of the scrotum, which I brought up. So I'm not a big fan. I would actually like to be an elephant if I was a male. Now, you guys who are males can all decide for yourselves, but I wouldn't want to have a sack in between my legs. You guys can decide. I don't know. That's for you to decide. I will tell you that the elephant, if any of you have ever looked, does not have his testes outside, is a mammal, and obviously is prolific. Right? So it turns out that the of all animals, the elephant, very smart animal, uses what we now use technology for, the air conditioner. Has its gonads inside, makes a lot more sense. And it takes the blood from its outside skin and brings it straight to its gonads to cool it down, and then back out again. So it has its own little air conditioning system. So you guys can decide what you'd prefer. I also will tell you that the elephant is really smart, also has a retractile penis. Why have that outside if you can take it out when you want? Doesn't make any sense. So I prefer the elephant. I will tell you, so that the males don't feel that they are being, you know, picked upon or whatever, that I'd also, for me as a female, prefer to be a cow. At least from my reproductive tract. Turns out that the cow, you know, I've talked about the embryo as part of the placenta. So the cow, the embryo is part of the placenta in humans or in any mammal, is your inner lining of your uterus. And what a pain, every month we lose it. The cow is really smart. Who needs all that? It just reabsorbs it. Why waste blood? Makes no sense. Okay? So I'd rather be a cow. You girls can decide if that's true for you too. And the males rather be an elephant. Okay, that you can decide. All right. But I'm missing one last piece. I haven't told you how we decide if we're going to have external male genitalia or female external genitalia. And that, it turns out, is at the bottom of 11B. You'll see on the left that it turns out that you need an actual more potent form of testosterone called dihydrotestosterone, which is written out there at the bottom. You can see it. Or we abbreviate it DHT, plus or minus, and that's decision number 4, in order to create a penis and a scrotum. Without it, you get external female genitalia, and that's actually what happens in the book Middlesex. I don't know how many of you have read it, but Middlesex, it turns out that in order to get DHT from testosterone, you need an enzyme called 5-alpha reductase. Please don't memorize that name. And in the book, the person in the book who at birth thinks he's a female but turns out to be male has all the right internal organs, but no 5-alpha reductase, no DHT, external genitals that are female. So Wolfian duct, testes, but external female genitalia. So, if you remember, I mentioned that, you know, I was going to talk about how you could be male or female. It turns out, because your sex chromosomes only determine your gonads, if things don't work correctly downstream from there, if you don't have testosterone, if you don't have AMH, if you don't have DHT, you can have some organs that are male and some organs that are female. If you have, for example, external female genitalia like in Middlesex, but all the rest is male, we call that a pseudo-hermaphrodite. So it's because different organs are different sexes. A true hermaphrodite requires that the gonad itself have some somatic tissues that are female or granulosa and thecal, and some tissues that are Sertoli and Leydig. So you have to have that your gonad itself contains both kinds of somatic tissues in order for you to be a hermaphrodite. Okay? One last thing I want to add, because I realized I didn't say it. I said the fact that the Leydig cells secrete testosterone. I have given the women a bum deal by not mentioning that these two together secrete both progesterone and estrogen, just to make our map complete, which are important. And I've also ignored puberty, okay? So you'll see that in the recitation this week, you will go through a person that has an issue with their sex. And I will tell you that one of the things that's nice about, well, nice and not nice about sex is that there are human mutations that we see all the time because you are viable even if you're not fertile. So one of the examples that you'll read, the example you'll use this week, you'll see what happens when some organs are male and some organs are female or vice versa. And how these four decisions can happen differently. And so you're not just either male or female, there are some individuals in between. Okay, thank you. Sure.
The whole idea of the artificial organs and then sort of introducing the stem cells. Like my grandmother has a titanium hip. When they were putting that in, did they need to introduce her stem cells so her body?
No. So they do a lot. They do both bone and hip replacement with big metal objects. They're working on making it. Again, those last about 10 years. Mm-hmm. So if you do it, let's say you have a sports injury and you want to do it when you're 20,
don't.
It's not so right because you'd have to do it again when you're 30. You know.
Yeah.
So they're trying to make biodegradable scaffolds for this to work on. And a lot of the people in biomedical engineering here are working on that. Like Clark Hung works on artificial knees. He's trying to make it out of biomaterial that'll last much longer and replenish itself.
Wow.
As opposed to jamming in these huge rods into your legs, you know.
Right.
So it's not the same, but it's something that works already and we're working on.
Okay.
We are working on, I mean, we're now working on trying to make it out of materials that will, with time, they're biodegradable and with stem cells, and they will make new, you know.
So then why is the metal not rejected by your body?
They use special metals, titanium and things like that, that don't get recognized so easily by the immune system.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Sure. So I find that people, because they're so used to Moshowitz, don't usually come so much now, but will come a lot the week of the exam. So I will have office hours the week of the exam, but what happens if I do it now is like one person comes and it's just kind of silly. But yes, I will definitely before the exam have office hours.
Okay.
I'll post them.
Great.
Okay? Testosterone is a biggie. You know, there was this woman who cast her in the Olympics, right, that she was running, and there were questions as to her sex? So they usually find that there's, you know, issues with these various decisions. So, for example, Castor that was in the Olympics, she had 10 times more testosterone than the average female. But a lot of our selection for women athletes is frequently for women who are on the high side of testosterone. Testosterone and growth hormone together work to, promote muscle. And so frequently our women are going to be, that are doing sports, are going to be on the higher end of testosterone, because of course it's a range. It's not that there's a specific amount. And all women have testosterone and all men have estrogen. It's just a matter of amounts.
So those levels also vary between races?
I don't know the answer to that. I don't know that anybody's ever done that because it's such a touchy question, right?
And I was like, to think about that.
I don't know that Yeah, I do know that for basketball, being tall helps. Okay, sure.
I have a question about the testosterone. If the embryo is developing the ovary and it has the granules and the fecal on the somatic cells, but what happens if outside testosterone is introduced?
The body doesn't know where the testosterone is from, so it will maintain your mullerian, but you may not get AMH, right? And so you would also maintain your mullerian.
Okay.
Right?
So you might maintain the mullerian.
And the wolfian, sure. They don't know about each other. So they, you know, each of them, if they got their signal. I will tell you, though, that has a little bit of a trouble there are people who are busy injecting testosterone because what I was just talking about, testosterone promotes muscle growth. So there's a lot of sports people who are busy injecting themselves with testosterone. For your sperm to develop well, they need to be bathed in testosterone. And so the fact that the source of testosterone is actually your Leydig cells right next to where your sperm are is really important. And your Sertoli cells capture that testosterone and use it at very high levels inside your gonad. If you inject it from outside and you have an outside source, your Leydig cells don't need to make testosterone because there's all that testosterone in your blood and it notices that. So your testes shrivel up. And then you're not fertile. So a lot of those guys who are busy injecting that are in sports are also making themselves infertile and shriveling up their...
Is it permanent?
So usually it's not permanent unless you do it for a really long time. And some people who've combined it with growth hormone have actually become infertile. It can become permanent if you're not careful.
What sort of issues, if the gonad develops into the ovary, what sort of issues come from having the wolfian duct still existing? It's connected directly to...
Right, but don't forget that the mullerian, which isn't connected, goes like this to get it. So you'd probably still have ovulation and be able to get it, even though you might have more chances of ectopic pregnancies where the embryo gets stuck in your body cavity and doesn't actually make it into your fallopian tubes. But I don't know.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
Sure.
Do Dolly's offspring also have shortened lifespan?
Yeah. And they're working on that. There's a lot of issues. I don't know how much you know about telomeres on the end of your chromosomes and all, and about various issues that Dolly had. She actually died of a respiratory disease, and I think her immune system wasn't... You know, there was a number of issues that she had.
But she passes it on to her kids, even if she has been the irregular method.
Okay, so they've done, for example, these telomere examples in mice. If you are... There's two components of the telomerase, the enzyme that elongates the ends of your chromosomes. If you're mutant for either one of them, they've actually done it for one of them, so I shouldn't say. The one they've done it for, okay, it's the part, because the telomerase, the enzyme, is made up of an RNA that they use as a template to extend, and a protein. If you, for example, knock out that protein, the first generation has a little bit of a phenotype. The second generation, even worse. By the fourth generation, you have a horrible phenotype. If you have one copy mutated, not the other, so you're heterozygous, right? If you then take the ones that have been heterozygous for four generations and you cross them with each other, with a wild type, even though now you have wild type amounts, it takes you another four generations to get back to normal. So it's not something that's corrected in one generation. It takes a number of generations to correct.
What would happen if you didn't make the scar tissue and you just functioned like a human? But what is the scar tissue for?
To kind of fill the space, right? Because what happens is the macrophages come and eat the cells, and there's really nothing there. You need something structure-wise to fill the space. So the fibroblasts secrete collagen and just structurally fill the space so it's not just a hole. Yeah, I mean, you first form a clot, and the clot's going to go away. So you need something instead of the clot, and that's the scar.
Why is the structure, like when you were talking about the trachea, why isn't that structure, the collagen and ECM, rejected?
Because slowly but surely it gets degraded, and new collagen is then secreted by those stem cells. So you end up getting the new ones.
Got it.
That's right. I didn't talk about that, but that's a good point.
You drew this diagram where you said stem cells regenerate and then these created neurons. This guy right here, I'm a little confused about. Would this ultimately create neurons as well, or are you just trying to show that this is a determined cell that is then...
So you need a guy in the middle. I didn't draw this one. right? But you need at least one guy in the...
No,
here it is. You added an extra cell. Oh, yeah, I did draw it. Oh, you're right. I'm sorry. I've lied. So, I could have, though, not drawn it. Why did I draw it this time? I don't know. So, I could have not drawn it, but it's the same idea. So, you need to have that it not be just a cell that comes from here that right away becomes a neuron, but rather it gives rise to cells that then will become neurons. It's like the progenitor field that I drew.
Okay. But they do, in other words, there is no intermediate type of cell. This is the stem cell. This guy differentiates and determines and becomes neurons, and so would this. There's no intermediate thing.
Well, there frequently is, because you need, in addition to the really good proliferating cells, some intermediate, like we call them progenitors, that will give rise to a bunch of neurons. So you actually have...
So they persist in that state and then die. They don't actually specialize.
Oh, eventually they would actually. You're right, but they'll probably give rise to a lot more offspring before they differentiate. But yes.
More divisions in here.
Yes.
Okay. And one other quick question. If Dolly had been made using... If the egg donor had been a sister of Dolly, so the mitochondrial DNA would be the same. Is that a true clone?
Well, the question is, how many... Very close. Will there be any of the mitochondria that will be different and that is changed and whatever? Who knows, right? But very close, right. Okay. It's not the same as an identical twin, which is even closer, but it's pretty good.
But even an identical twin.
But you do realize that probably wouldn't be an option. Well, you could have like a brother that's... I mean, a sister that's 15 years younger than you that's still reproductive.
Since the mitochondrial DNA is matrilineal,
I understand.
Narrow, isn't it? Like, so
yes, it's only a matter of whatever mutations or... Yes, mm-hmm. You're right. That's very close. Yes.
Thanks a lot.
Yep.
Hi. So when you're talking about... what about, that
right.
And so then just...
Well, it turns out that you can...